Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Charlie Cray, corporate reform campaigner at Citizen Works, who examines the charges of war profiteering leveled against Halliburton and other companies with close ties to the Bush administration. Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign, who assesses the rulings issued in a recent court challenge to McCain-Feingold campaign finance legislation and its possible fate in the U.S. Supreme Court. And Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, who discusses the importance of the fight against AIDS in Africa and legislation proposed by the White House to fund prevention and treatment on the continent hardest hit by the epidemic. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that 3 years ago, current U.S. Defense Chief Donald Rumsfeld sat on the corporate board of ABB, a European engineering giant that sold two light-water nuclear reactors to North Korea. The deal was part of the Clinton-era policy of engagement with Pyongyang. In 1999, ABB executive Goran Lindahl visited North Korea to pursue a wide-ranging, long-term cooperation agreement. A year later, a deal was signed for the nuclear reactors, although Rumsfeld no longer remembers voting for it. Rumsfeld sat on the ABB board for 11 years, until he became Bush's Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld earned $190,000 a year on the ABB board. Once he joined the Bush team, Rumsfeld took a hawkish line on North Korea. In January 2002, the Bush administration branded North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil. Despite the hardline policy and North Korea's withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the White House continues to fund ABB's nuclear project to the tune of $3.5 million. Some arms control experts have serious questions about Rumsfeld's relationship with North Korea. As Steve LaMontagu of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation explains, one could draw the conclusion that economic and personal interests took precedent over non-proliferation. The New York Observer reports that in early March, Cindy Corey spoke with her daughter Rachel on the telephone for the last time. Her mother was in Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress on behalf of human rights for Palestinians and U.S. protection for international activists like Rachel in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. 23-year-old Rachel Corey was a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, who nonviolently resisted the Israeli occupation. On March 16th, Rachel Corey was killed while trying to stop the demolition of a house owned by a Palestinian doctor in the Gaza Strip. She was run over by an American-made Israeli army bulldozer. Corey's death, condemned by Amnesty International, signaled a new crackdown on ISM by the Israeli army and their nonviolent direct action tactics. In recent weeks, two other ISM volunteers have been badly injured in shootings by Israeli soldiers. Brian Avery, who was shot in the head in the embattled city of Jenin, and Tom Horndahl, a British activist who was shot while pushing Palestinian children away from an approaching Israeli tank in the Gaza town of Rafah, the same town where Rachel Corey was killed. On May 9th, just days before a visit by American Secretary of State Colin Powell, the Israeli army raided the ISM office near Bethlehem. They arrested an American ISM volunteer and sought to have her deported. The Army also seized ISM computers and video equipment. But despite the violence, ISM reports recent events have actually resulted in more international volunteers stepping up to resist Israeli occupation. Washington has escalated its campaign against Cuba by expelling 14 U.S.-based Cuban diplomats for, according to an unnamed U.S. official, engaging in activities inconsistent with diplomatic status. According to the Associated Press, the Bush administration now requires Cuban diplomats in Washington to obtain State Department approval when hiring local workers for jobs at the Cuban Interest Section in Washington, D.C. All this falls on the heels of actions recently taken by Cuba for exercising what supporters claim are its sovereign rights against U.S. interference in Cuban internal affairs. 75 government opponents were arrested in Havana recently for accepting U.S. funds in violation of Cuba's legal and penal codes. Authorities accused them of collaborating directly with James Kaysen, who is head of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana. Since his arrival in September of last year, Kaysen has unabashedly met with Cuban dissidents in his own home and given them access to the Interest Section. Three ringleaders who were part of an 11-member gang of armed hijackers were executed for their role in seizing a Havana passenger ferry in early April. The executions ended a near three-year temporary moratorium on the use of the death penalty on the island. Four other hijackers responsible for recent air and naval acts of piracy in Cuba remain uncharged and are at liberty in Miami. All hijacked property remains in U.S. hands, despite an official Cuban request for its return. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and your reporter, Denise Manzari.
Well before the Bush administration launched its war against Baghdad, U.S. corporations were lining up to win lucrative contracts for the rebuilding of Iraq, a nation devastated by war and 12 years of economic sanctions. But because companies with close ties to the White House, such as Halliburton, Bechtel, and the Carlyle Group, have been awarded multi-million dollar contracts in post-war Iraq, questions are now being raised about the appearance of ethical impropriety and conflicts of interest. The revolving door between big business and government is easily illustrated in the Bush White House. Richard Perle, a key architect of the Iraq War, resigned his chairmanship of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board in March after press reports revealed he was acting as a highly paid consultant for companies hoping to profit from conflicts in Iraq and North Korea. And before becoming Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld sat on the board of a Swiss company which had signed a $200 million contract with North Korea in 1999 to design and build components for two light water nuclear reactors there. But the most disturbing example of possible conflicts of interest in the Bush administration are seen in Vice President Dick Cheney's association with Halliburton, an oil services and construction company that regularly does business with the Pentagon. Halliburton, where Cheney served as CEO from 1995 to 2000, was awarded a no-bid contract in March to put out oil fires in post-war Iraq, and as revealed by the U.S. Army in May, to operate Iraq's oil fields and distribute its petroleum products. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Charlie Cray, corporate reform campaigner with Citizen Works, who examines the charges of war profiteering leveled against Halliburton and other companies with close ties to the White House.
Well, the Defense Policy Board has 30 members, nine of whom have ties to companies that have won more than $76 billion in defense contracts in 2001 and 2002. Four members are registered lobbyists, and one represents two of the three largest defense contractors. You have kind of issues of conflicts of interest, and you have larger questions concerning whether or not some of the ostensible basis of our foreign policy isn't contradicted by the private activities of some of the people involved. For instance, take Vice President Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton. One of the stories that has not come out except for the good graces, the good persistence of Henry Waxman, is the fact that Halliburton has done business in Iran and during Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq through offshore subsidiaries. And Cheney was confronted about this and at first denied that early on, I think, when in his presidency or while he was a candidate, actually, for office. And it later was proven to be true, and he sort of avoided responsibility for it, I guess, by claiming that this was an activity of a subsidiary and that the company didn't really know much about it. The hypocrisy there is that, you know, here's a company that's doing business with regimes that this administration has deemed to be supporters of terrorism.
Vice President Dick Cheney still gets quite a bit of money every year from Halliburton, a company that has been recently awarded contracts from the U.S. government. Do you want to outline the compensation package that Dick Cheney is still getting and the lucrative contracts that Halliburton is receiving right now?
Dick Cheney's relationship with Halliburton goes back 11 years to when he was Secretary of Defense under President Bush. And he, at that time, establish a relationship with Halliburton by hiring Kellogg Brown and Root, their subsidiary, to look at how the Defense Department could more efficiently manage some of its operations by inviting private contractors in to perform those services. Then he went to work for Halliburton and became the CEO, and Halliburton grew to become from something like the 78th largest to the 17th largest defense contractor under Dick Cheney's leadership. And then he, of course, came back into government office, but it apparently seems like he hasn't lost his connection to Halliburton. He continues to receive almost $200,000 in annual compensation as a retirement package from Halliburton. Also, a little-known story is that the vice president's office met with Halliburton in October, along with other representatives of the oil industry, to discuss oil production in Iraq after Saddam was gone. This is back in October, before any decision of going to war was even officially made. That's a meeting that we don't know a lot about. It was reported on by the Wall Street Journal by Thaddeus Herrick on the 16th of January, and the administration denied it even occurred, much like they won't cough up the documents from the National Energy Strategy. There's a lot of secrecy involved in the relationships between this administration and the corporations that they have deep ties with, particularly the oil and gas industry. The administration has about 41 members of top-level administration representatives that came out of the oil and gas industry, including people like Condoleezza Rice, who once had an oil tanker owned by Chevron named after her.
Are the connections between Vice President Dick Cheney and Halliburton just the appearance of impropriety, or through your research, do you feel that there is the basis for a congressional investigation of what's going on here?
I think there's enough evidence for a congressional investigation into Dick Cheney and Halliburton based on two lines of evidence. One is the story reported in the Wall Street Journal on the 16th of January that the vice president's office met with Halliburton and members of other companies back in October to plan oil production in Iraq. There is evidence that this was a closed bidding process that excluded companies that had the qualifications to be able to do business there. And why were they shut out? I think that question needs to be answered. The second line of evidence is that this is an administration, and Dick Cheney in particular, has a long-standing relationship that makes it way too cozy with this company. Where is the evidence that there is some kind of accountability to the taxpayer for cost overruns given this company's track record in the past? I think it may be time for us to start calling on members of Congress to set up a special prosecutor or investigator, at least, to look into these conflicts of interest and to answer questions that so far only Henry Waxman has had the courage to pursue. I think people can ask for, at minimum, ask for greater transparency, that these contracts should be posted on a website for everybody to see.
That was Charlie Cray, corporate reform campaigner at Citizen Works. Contact the group by calling area code 202-265-6164 or visit their website at www.citizenworks.org. After years of struggle for campaign finance reform, Congress passed legislation which banned unregulated soft money contributions made to political parties by corporations, unions, and individuals. The measure, named for its sponsors Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, also restricted TV and radio issue advertising, referring to specific candidates within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. But shortly after President Bush signed the measure into law last year, the constitutionality of the legislation was challenged by the Republican Party and a coalition of groups, including the National Rifle Association. 5 months after first hearing the case, a three-judge panel in Washington's U.S. District Court issued four opinions on May 2nd relating to McCain-Feingold. In its rulings, the court struck down some key provisions of the law while upholding others, creating a mixed result for supporters and opponents. But in the end, this decision is only temporary, as the U.S. Supreme Court will have the final say when it hears the case later this year. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nick Neihardt, Executive Director of Public Campaign, who examines the lower court rulings and McCain-Feingold's possible fate in the Supreme Court. Neihardt also discusses his group's ongoing effort to institute a publicly funded clean money campaign finance system for candidates at the state level.
It's sort of a hodgepodge, but to put it in perspective, one thing to remember is that the soft money that they talk about and they deal with, of the $3 billion that was spent at the federal level on influencing elections in the 2000 cycle, only about $500 million was soft money. So it's about $1 in every six, although it's growing. So you still have the hard money as a problem. The second thing to remember is whatever these guys said, the Supreme Court has the final say. And under the terms of McCain-Feingold, they wrote into the law an appeal to the Supreme Court. So it'll be reviewed by the court. And while this panel in D.C. Issued 1,600 pages worth of rulings, and people are digging into it quite deeply, it really isn't going to mean that much when all is said and done, because the Supreme Court will have a final say. On the other hand, the ruling was put into effect immediately, which means that all the people who raise political money are reading it carefully to try and figure out what money they can raise and what they can do with it until the Supreme Court ruling comes down. To further complicate matters, people on both sides of the case have asked for stays of the effects of the ruling. In other words, people who were pro McCain-Feingold and against it have found enough to dislike in this ruling on both sides that they've asked for a stay of the implementation of the ruling. So it's very possible in the next week or two there'll be a ruling that comes down and says, whatever they said, we're holding it off from going into effect until the Supreme Court has ruled. Now, having said all that as a preface, there was one judge who was very anti-McCain-Feingold and thought it was all unconstitutional just about, one who was very supportive of it, and that left a judge in the middle who was supportive of some aspects of the law and not of others. And so in the end, you have 1,600 pages of a hodgepodge ruling that in some areas say, no, you can't ban parties from raising soft money. But on the other hand, you can restrict the use of that soft money once it's raised. In fact, and one kind of use of soft money, that is electioneering, they actually went further than the McCain-Feingold law did and said you cannot electioneer, in other words, run ads that support or oppose a candidate at all. And the law had said you just can't use name or likeness of a candidate within 60 days of a general election or 30 days of a primary. So in some ways, the court ruling went further than the McCain-Feingold law did, and in other ways, it pulled it back. I actually think what it portends is another complicated and perhaps divided decision from the Supreme Court, in which we'll see various justices arguing the legality or unconstitutionality of different parts of the law. We'll probably wind up with a split decision, and the court will wind up somewhere in the middle, the Supreme Court will, in terms of upholding the law or striking it down, because there's so many different provisions in the law, it's easy for different judges to have different opinions about the different positions. In any case, whether the law is entirely upheld or entirely thrown out, we're still going to have a big money and politics problem when all is said and done.
Nick Neihardt, when you look at the possible effect of this interim decision on the presidential and congressional elections coming up next year, who's at an advantage or a disadvantage depending on which way this thing goes?
Statistically anyway, the Republicans have had a big advantage in raising hard money, and so anything that restricts soft money and forces people to rely more on hard money in the presidential race favors Republicans. On the other hand, even if the law is upheld in its entirety, there are enough loopholes in the law that soft money will still have an effect. It simply won't go directly through the political parties. But if you look at straight party interests, the Republicans, at least in the short term, will make out better. And I think the other thing you need to do is step back and clearly understand that under any system of private financing, an incumbent who's closely aligned with wealthy interests will always have an advantage because they can deliver policy in a much better way than their challenger can.
I know there are six states that currently have what you call clean money public financing election laws, and that's New Mexico, North Carolina, Arizona, Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts. People have been very distracted by other major issues, war, terrorism, and the like, the horrible economy. Is public support still out there for this?
Oh, sure. I mean, when you ask people, would you support a new system of financing candidates, under which candidates who agree to spending limits and agree to give up private money would receive money from a public fund on which to run their campaigns, we consistently get between 65 and 70% support on that question at the state level and the national level as well. The bigger enemy, though, is cynicism. I think people are so fed up with politics, ordinary Americans are, that they really wonder if any kind of system, any kind of reform will be effective. That's why we're so glad we have both Maine and Arizona to point to, because you have a real improvement in the political system in those two states.
That was Nick Neihardt, executive director with Public Campaign. Contact the group by calling area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at www.publiccampaign.org. The AIDS pandemic has killed 25 million people worldwide over the past two decades, the vast majority in Africa, where it continues to spread virtually unchecked. President Bush scored points with many concerned about the epidemic when, during his State of the Union address in January, he announced a $15 billion aid package for AIDS prevention and treatment in Africa over the next 5 years. But critics noted that most of the money was backloaded, that is, slated for budgets towards the end of the five-year period. And there was no proposal for a supplemental budget appropriation this year, such as was passed last month to pay for the war in Iraq. Critics also charge that the administration is planning to establish a new bureaucracy to control and administer most of the funds, rather than channeling all the money through the United Nations-sponsored Global Fund for AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. Still, the fact that new funds are being made available, both for prevention and treatment, is a positive development, say those working in the field. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action. Over the years, the group has focused its attention on the struggle against colonialism, apartheid, the debt burden hindering development, and other issues affecting the continent. Now the group's primary focus is on combating HIV/AIDS, part of its Africa's Right to Health campaign. Booker discusses the strengths and weaknesses of the White House proposed legislation on AIDS prevention and treatment in Africa.
The forward movement is on increasing the funding levels. The backward movement, however, are these conservative amendments that were put into the bill that would require that a third of the funding for prevention efforts would be used to finance abstinence-only until marriage programs. The Second Amendment simply says that faith-based groups that will be subsidized with these funds are free to exempt themselves from certain types of programs that they oppose, such as condom distribution.
Are there any changes, any differences in the Senate bill than what was already adopted in the House? And if so, do you think that any of those differences would be an improvement in the overall bill?
The basic difference is that the Senate bill is probably not going to have this abstinence-only provision, which is good in our view. And it's not likely to have the other conservative amendment that's in the House bill that allows recipients of this money to opt out of programs that are considered against their conscience, like condom distribution. So that's not likely to be in the Senate bill. The Senate bill is likely to have a guarantee for $1 billion to go to the Global Fund. The House version says up to $1 billion. The figures we're now talking about may seem large to people, but when compared to the $79 billion that was just passed in the Congress last month as a supplemental for funding the war on Iraq, one gets a measure of the misplaced priorities. AIDS as a public health crisis, the worst catastrophe in recorded human history, is a far greater global threat today than terrorism or even weapons of mass destruction. It's killing more people annually, some 3 million people in 2002. It's destroying more families, undermining more societies and economies, and destabilizing more countries than any other global threat. You see a lot of attention now given to the SARS epidemic, and that is a significant public health concern, but it's nothing on the magnitude of HIV/AIDS, which has been going for two decades. But it's largely because it's affecting mostly black people in Africa, the Caribbean, increasingly here in the United States. And it's always been viewed as a disease affecting others, be they in Africa or racial or sexual minorities here in the United States. The United States has not been contributing significantly to treatment programs, and that is to programs to save lives, to provide people who are living with HIV and AIDS access to treatment. Less than 1% of people living with AIDS in Africa have access to the antiretroviral drugs that are indicated for treatment. And it's only because of the introduction of generic competition from producers in Brazil or India, as well as the pressure of activists that have brought the prices down to begin to make it possible for people in poor countries to have access to these kinds of drugs.
One of the Republicans in the House was citing the success of Uganda in reducing the number of AIDS cases, and according to him, it was because they adopted this three-pronged approach of stressing abstinence, fidelity, and the use of condoms. In Uganda, did fidelity and abstinence play a role, do you know, in reducing the incidence?
Uganda sort of pioneered the much-touted ABC model, A for abstinence, B for be faithful or monogamous if you're having sexual relations, and C for using condoms. Uganda was one of the first African countries to make a really public push in public education on HIV/AIDS, and the ABC model was the model they employed. They were able to reduce the HIV infection rate from 15% of the population to 5% in terms of new infections. So this was dramatic. This was a major success. But studies in Uganda and a study by the Alan Guttmacher Institute have demonstrated that it's really the C, the use of condoms, that was the most significant element of that approach, and that the A, abstinence, contributed relatively little to the success in Uganda.
That was Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action. Call Africa Action at area code 202-546-7961 or visit their website at www.africaaction.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.